All across Eurasia, from the Siberian east to the coasts of Normandy in the west, there lives a butterfly called the Halcon Large Blue. It has brown grayish wings and a deep blue body without any brilliant gloss. It can be seen flying in mid to late summer over damp meadows, marshes, and moorlands. They only feed on one kind of flower, and when they find it, they send down their larva to the ground by a secreted rope where the white alien-looking caterpillar waits to be discovered by ants. It emits surface chemicals called allomons, which is Greek for pheromones of the other. A way of saying that the little parasite pretends to smell like the children of the ants, which upon discovery, shocked that one of their own were left unprotected in the wild, unforgiving outside, quickly bring it back home to the brooding chambers of the communal ant hill. Here, as things go, individuals are fed collectively by the community, with hope that they one day will become productive members of that totality in whatever way they naturally can. The nurse ants adopt the alien larva with its slimy white appearance and black protruding greedy mouth as its own. They feed it what they themselves have eaten, puking up half-digested sustenance into the little needy opening of the young, watching as it grows bigger and healthier. Hungrier. As to not arouse suspicion, the infiltrator does not bother the real grubs of the ants. It does not eat members of its host, as does other less conspiring members of the large blue butterfly genus. Having pursued a higher degree of social integration through cunning mimicry of the lingo that keeps the ant community together in the construction of the Great Hill, they have a higher chance of surviving when a nest is overcrowded or facing food shortage because ants preferentially feed the larva. Compared to the type of scramble competition that can devastate predatory larvae, this contest competition results in much lower mortality. Over time, some ant colonies that are parasitized in this manner will slightly change their larva chemicals as a defense, leading to an evolutionary arms race between the two species. Avoiding the purchase of the saboteurs has pushed the Halcon Large Blue so far down the path of lies that it cannot survive without the benevolence of the ants. So far has it progressed on its deceitful path that in times of great turmoil, when the ants are struggling to maintain their way of life, the maggots will imitate the sound of the queen's offspring, pretending to be one of the heirs that will make sure that the greater good of the hill has an organized future. The nurses work tirelessly to make sure that at least the high caste members receive the nutrition they need. The Halcon Blue's con is unusual in this regard in that it uses different host species in different locations throughout Europe and Russia, and often uses multiple host species even within the same location and population. Though it may be adopted into the nests of multiple Myrmissa ants species within a given site, there is typically one primary species with which the locally adapted larva can best socially integrate, leading to drastically higher survival rates. The biggest enemy is a parasitic wasp, the ichneumon. It too has lost the honest way and has become fully dependent on eating Halcon Blue maggots. It will enter an infiltrated ant collective, spray its lie serum, turning ant against ant, and in the turmoil seek out the alien. Inject it with its eggs, and on pupation the wasp eggs hatch and consume the chrysalis from the inside. If this does not take place, the pine needle welfare state will raise the butterfly as its own until it reaches adulthood. At that point in time, the Social Democrat will show its true blue-brown colors and quickly escape the fury of the confused red ants. Upon spreading its wings, it sings an ode to peaceful reform and flies back home to the parliaments of bourgeois democratic representation, feeling there is a game of honesty in taking advantage of hard workers. No, it does not, Marcus. No, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Hello and welcome to the return of the repressed, dear listeners. I'm so sorry. I recently had the time to, you know, watch a lot of nature films with my son, and I just could not help myself. I'm very happy to sit down with you again. We have a lot to get through. The notes keep on growing. So, where were we? Well, that's right. We want to know, in the absence of centralization, what the 1917-1927 science policy nonetheless looked like. Just so we can see, you know, what environment a young and aspiring Trofim Lysenko was trying to orientate. Well, Soviet historian Paul R. Josephson concludes, and I have to agree, that it cannot be said that the Soviet Union had a unified national science policy in the first decade of its existence. The absence of such a unified national policy was a major factor in the success of both communist and non-communist scientists in founding competing scientific research institutes after the Bolshevik Revolution. Which is not hard to understand if we think about it. This had never been done before, and even though Marx and Engels had written on such varied topics as the part played by labor in transition from ape to man and the mathematical problem of zero divided by zero, both interesting texts, no question about it, I made some pirate publishing covers for them on a free university printer back in the day. But that does not leave out the fact that they never left behind any texts on how to guide and organize that crucial force of production, which in Grundrisse Marx called the Allgemeinen Verstand, the general intellect. After all, as the Beard pointed out, quote, "Nature builds no machines, no locomotives, railways, electric telegraphs, self-acting mules, etc. These are products of human industry, natural material transformed into organs of the human will over nature, or of human participation in nature. They are organs of the human brain, created by the human hand. The power of knowledge objectified." End of quote. And now, here, for the first time in history, that force had to be circuited by professional revolutionaries, the vast majority of which lacked a degree in the so-called hard sciences and engineering. As we have hinted at, the scientific departments, elitist by their nature, became a place where very reactionary ideas could hide in obscurity in the absence of a national science policy. Lenin himself had already gotten involved in the Mach versus Einstein dispute on radical empiricism, where Vladimir, supporting Albert, argued against Ernst's position, according to which Ernst Mach advocated that only sensory experiences have actual reality, and thus argued in favor of the non-existence of atoms. The nature of radical empiricism will return with fervor in coming episodes, so it is only wise that we make this brief mention of Lenin's stance in the matter, which, if I wasn't clear, was in favor of the existence of atoms, and as such against the position of radical empiricism. At first, in general, most Bolshevik party leaders sought an accommodation with scientists through such organizations as the Academy of Sciences and the Commission for the Study of the Productive Forces, hoping to gain their cooperation in the task of quote-unquote government construction. Some envisaged the creation of a commissariat of science to centralize and coordinate government science policy. In addition, the proletkultists believed that to achieve that in any meaningful socialist way, science needed to be purged of all its bourgeois inheritance, so that it would then be infused with a proletarian ethos and make possible, for the first time ever, social mobility within the educational apparatuses. In the first years of Soviet power, mainly under such officials as Anatoly Lunacharsky, a big educational reformer and proletkult guy, as well as Felix Dzerzhinsky, whom Stalin later referred to as, quote, a devout knight of the proletariat, designed a program which gave rather extensive leeway to scientists in the management of their institutes and in the choice of their research programs. I can't say with certainty, but it seems that Lysenko himself, a promising collective peasant from a rural experimentation station, would have benefited a great deal from the polytechnical reforms that Lunacharsky and Dzerzhinsky tried to implement. After all, he was born too soon to benefit from the social mobility programs that began in earnest under Stalin, almost a decade later, that aimed to create a new young elite force of cadres. We will speak about that more in episodes to come, but it is of course interesting to note already, as surely some of you have guessed, that though it is in my opinion way too simplistic to call every enemy of the Let's Educate the Peasant project a Trotskyite, though many of them were, as we will see, Leon's own distrust for the peasantry as a revolutionary class already expressed itself here in polemic battles with Lunacharsky. Lunacharsky, who seemed to have been Leon's comrade initially, wrote somewhere, if I remember correctly, that he had never met someone more egotistical and incapable of making friends, but nonetheless admired his steadfastness in opinion. Dzerzhinsky, on the other hand, seemed to have hated Trotsky before it became a trend. His last 2 hour speech, after which he immediately died of a heart attack in 1926, was a massive attack on the over-educated, privileged sophistry of the United Opposition, directed by Leon Trotsky, Georgi Zinoviev, and Lev Kamenev. Having grown up in a social democratic country which loves meeting more than anything else, I would go so far as to say that offices and schedules in Sweden are often strictly designed for this purpose alone. I read the little which I could get a hold of in English as one of the most on-point critiques of the things which these aforementioned Russian social democrats had not learned during the few years that they started to call themselves communists. And I mean opposing meetings about meetings until your heart literally just gives up is something we should all try to, you know, imitate to the best of our capabilities. kids, be more like Felix. Iron Felix, as he was known, who defeated juvenile delinquency and homelessness, is also credited with bringing order to the law enforcement bodies of the young Soviet Republic, and was in 1924-1926, as is extra useful for our investigation, studying agriculture, which made him realize, just like our Narodnik nobleman Engelhardt from the last episode, that the Communist Party had to change the system of bureaucracy or fail. Because again, the distrust of the peasantry, a relic from the old system, was probably one of the biggest hindrances to the whole project. But there is no surprise that I would conclude that. Though, of course, as I made clear by citing Lenin's late 19th century text, the Social Democrats had some reason for this distrust, as the Narodniks and the peasantry had failed miserably in their historical task. Felix said, quote, "We need to cut the red tape, the scribbling, the flow of documents in which we are drowning. It is necessary to restructure the work, to wipe useless bureaucratic units and assign more responsibility to those who are engaged in work. We need to avoid such a bureaucratic system when it is not us who know what we're doing, but pieces of paper in our portfolios." End of quote. And he goes on, quote, "The work of the machinery of the state should be brought to a razor-sharp, fast pace. We suffer organizational fetishism. It seems to us that to start working, it is enough to take a paper, sit down in one's office and write, quote, within quote, take energetic measures, raise funds, and so on. It is not institutions that function, but people working in these institutions. It must be clear who is personally responsible for what. Self-responsibility should grow. Infinite collegiality, commissions, meetings, etc., have become a hindrance. A lot of time is spent on meetings and commissions. Cutting them, we are expanding the system of personal responsibility. It is necessary that we are not pulled back and forth, and we, in our turn, should not pull others." End of quote. According to Molotov, quote, "Dzerzhinsky declared war, as he had done before, to homelessness, to the defects and vices of the management system, the bureaucratic red tape," end of quote. And yeah, I guess I have to agree. The state of the bureaucracy in the 20s allowed several very different organizations responsible for the administration of scientific research and development to be active in the support of scientific research. As a result, in the two major governmental organizations for the conduct of science policy, Glavnauka, which was the main scientific administration of the People's Commissariat for Education, or Narkompros, and the Scientific Technical Department of Vesenka, which was the superior board of the People's Economy, their officials and scientists did not coordinate their activities into a single scheme. In fact, they competed furiously with each other for influence. Scientists were thus able to obtain support during the hard times of revolution, civil war, and war communism from both Glavnauka and the Scientific Technical Department, and if not through them, then through contracts with factories or Glavki, that is the chief administration of the Vesenka, whom might not be in the Scientific Technical Department specifically, as well as through other agencies and departments. Thus, many of the centers of research created after the revolution of October 1917 arose primarily as a result of the initiative of physicists, chemists, and biologists, and not as a result of any master plan drew up by party leaders or government officials. They competed with each other for financial support and received it from a number of sources. You could say, if you wanted to be cute, like I like to be at times, that the USSR in the Roaring Twenties lacked their own John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie. Did you know, by the way, that the Sainsbury family, who dominates the supermarket commodity circulation in the UK with Tesco, also runs a, quote, Great Gatsby Science Enhancement Program. The founder, John James Sainsbury, who died in peak party years of 1928, was known for avoiding personal publicity, and thus, as the biography goes, little evidence remains of his character. Anyways, mysterious educational philanthropist aside, our Slavic academicians worked under conditions of hardship during the first decade of the Soviet regime, but they were not constricted by any doctrinaire scheme of the planning of science, nor were they coerced into applied research. Well into the 1920s, such institutes as the Leningrad Physico-Technical Institute under Abraham Joffe, who received the Stalin Prize in 1941 for establishing various research laboratories dealing with solid-state physics, electromagnetism, radioactivity, superconductivity, and nuclear physics. That is to say, the major physics institute in the Soviet Union before the Second World War, were able to follow out their own research programs and to obtain funds from both Glavnauka and the Scientific Technical Department, as well as to raise funds through research contracts. One just has to learn how to play the game, I guess. Now, despite what I said earlier, playing games often meant, as a matter of fact, that though the USSR lacked its own Rockefeller and Carnegie et al., such men, a small group of wealthy industrialists, which of course includes them, were already busy, as we know, in setting up an international network of scientists to aid their own global alternative to the modernist project of the nation-state. And in the metropolitan world of world science, Russians were, of course, also invited. Now, whether writing about the going-ons in the state apparatus and its secrets of organization, weaknesses and strengths, etc., to their foreign colleagues on the same philanthropic payroll, if that constitutes solid ground for an investigation of conspiracy, we will eventually find out, and we can play the role of judges together. But to give a very rudimentary idea of what the chessboard looked like, we will summarize that Glavnauka had within its purview most of the institutes of fundamental research in physics, chemistry, and biology. The Scientific Technical Department had the majority of institutes of the applied sciences, that is, those closer to the, quote, productive process. Again, these activities were by no means coordinated. Only at the end of the decade did this situation change when anti-factionalist policies towards science were introduced. It was then that the centralizing tendencies triumphed over decentralization. The Supreme Economic Council and later the Commissariat of Heavy Industry, Narkomtjasprom, triumphed over Narkompros Glavnauka. Most physics and chemistry institutes, which had been under the loose rein of Glavnauka, came under the jurisdiction of the Narkomtjasprom to perform some unheard of great leaps, hitherto in history, of industrialization. At that time, the 30s onwards, let's say, the Soviet Union would come to acquire a science policy to which the name of, quote-unquote, the planning of science became attached. It was in fact a policy of the requirement that more research be aimed at the application of results and of the reform of the administrations of scientific research institutes by party workers and government officials. In conclusion, we can see then that though everything under heaven was in utter chaos, as the decade came to an end with the new decrees calling for applied results, this meant for some, those with a very practical out in the field bent, that the situation was excellent. For others, those who loved the new idea of the lab and wanted the newest, most expensive gadgets from their international backers, as we will soon see, found it very hard to, in words, justify their spending of Soviet tax money. Let's think of it initially as the dispute between detectives and forensic pathologists, which we know so well from our favorite crime shows, and how these two perspectives might define a crime, or rather how they might differ on what needs to be done first when finding a decaying body in the soil out on a rural field. The decaying body here being, in the words of Iron Felix, the bureaucratization of the first successful communist revolution.
Привет, дорогой друг, как там расцветает наш собой луг? Взошли ли из-под снега полевые цветы? Взошел ли из-под снега ты? Согревает ли солнце днем тебе руки? Что ты делаешь ночью, спасаясь от скуки? Убиваешь ли вечером песни часы? Убиваешься утром вкусом росы? Живая земля появилась из-под снега, и я играю руками между лучей солнца. Ночами скучаю, пока оно не проснется. Вечерами пою, закрывая глаза. По утрам меня умывает роса.
Вспоминаю о многом, все письма храня, уже очень давно рядом нет тебя.
Listen to the rest of this episode, please subscribe to the Patreon or on Spotify. If you subscribe, you will not only learn more about Lysenko and the days when genetic reductionism took over, you will also be given access to well-researched extended series that will take you on a long journey through the parapolitical history of cannabis, the murder of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in the 80s, or how New Ageism, ufology, and the ancient aliens narrative came to be through the Stargate conspiracy, as well as other upcoming future originally researched projects that you will not find anywhere else. I live in a small house in a small Alp village with my partner and a young boy, tending a natural farm with an old man in his 70s. I wish to make this podcast show my full-time job whilst providing my local retired community and kindergarten with good, healthy food. It's very difficult for me to maintain regular office jobs as a diagnosed psychotic, so please consider supporting this project with a few dollars. Thank you very much, and hope to see you there soon.